the radical, subversive love of Christ. That's what I want to try to talk about for the time that is ours this morning. This amazing story found in John's Gospel is a textbook example of the awesomeness of God's love. In fact, when you consider the very DNA of the gospel, it's all about love. That is the reason that out of all the moral and ethical virtues, the Bible says that love is the greatest. In 1 Corinthians 13, Paul declares with prophetic insight, "And now abides faith, hope, and love, these three, but the greatest of these is love." In fact, the litmus test for our right relationship with God is love. For the writer of 1 John says, "For we know that we have moved from death to life when we have love for one another. For anyone who does not love remains in death." Augustine was right when he described the heartbeat of the gospel as a hermeneutic of double love, love for God and love for neighbor. I tell you, it's all about love. Well, as we come to our text, we see a powerful and penetrating portrait of the enormity of God's love, not just for those who are like us, but for those whose histories, backgrounds, social locations, ethnicities, socioeconomic status are different from our own. In our text, Jesus meets a woman at Jacob's well. This well was not just a place where people went to gather water and to quench their thirst, but it was also a place where they would show up to wash their clothes, chat with friends, catch up on the latest gossip, feed their flocks, and simply check up on one another. I imagine in those days, if you were searching for someone, you could find them sooner or later simply by showing up at the well. It was a central gathering place, a common corner where people went to see and to be seen. And so it's not surprising to me that this common spot in Samaria finds itself on the itinerary of Jesus, that radical preacher from Galilee. In fact, verse 4 says, "But he had to go through Samaria." In other words, the text teaches us that Jesus had a providential purpose and a divine reason for going through Samaria. Now listen, if Jesus had to go through Samaria, as the text claims, the reason clearly had more to do with theology than it had to do with geography. Jesus said, "I had to go through Samaria because of a divine appointment with a marginalized and unempowered woman from Samaria." The fact that Jesus had to go through Samaria is significant because in those days, a certain sect of the Judeans did not associate with the Samaritans. They didn't want to hang around them. They didn't want to be around them. They didn't want to talk to them, and they traveled in completely different social circles. For verse 9, in another translation, reminds us that the Judeans had no dealings with the Samaritans. In fact, they had such disdain and loathing and hatred for the Samaritans that they even refused to travel through Samaria, even when it was the shortest route to their destination. That's what's going on in the text. And to the surprise of the disciples, Jesus bucks tradition, and he says, "Enough of this foolishness. I'm going through Samaria." Even though it was socially unacceptable, even though the Samaritans were considered half-breeds and unworthy of salvation, none of that stops Jesus from showing up. In the text, we see four invisible walls that stand between Jesus and this Samaritan woman. There's a religious wall, there's a gender wall, an ethnic wall, and a cultural wall. And Jesus' decision to subvert all of them is a theological statement consistent with the declaration, "For God so loved the world." I love that about Jesus. Against public opinion, against prevailing attitudes, against what is socially acceptable, Jesus shows up in Samaria. This was a place of ethnic tension. This was a place of ethnic hatred. This was a place of marginalization and unfairness. In fact, the term Samaritan was also considered an ethnic slur. Why? Because it was a term reserved for Jewish people who had intermarried with the Assyrians during and after the Assyrian invasions. The Samaritans were considered social outcasts, and they were dismissed and ignored and relegated to the junk heaps of society. But yet and still, Jesus shows up anyway. Look at Jesus. Jesus doesn't test the wind. Jesus doesn't take a poll to see if it's popular. Jesus doesn't wait until everybody is okay with it. Jesus doesn't wait until there is a consensus, but Jesus breaks the cultural code of his day and goes through Samaria. This was a radical act, and this was a bold move. But listen, if going through Samaria was not subversive and radical enough, if going through Samaria was not mind-blowing enough, check out Jesus. As he goes through Samaria, Jesus has the nerve to stop at the colored water fountain. Come on now, I like that. Because remember, back in the day, there were separate water fountains, one for blacks and one for whites. Well, Jesus bucks tradition and he stops at the colored water fountain because understand something. During those biblical times, there were prohibitions against sharing utensils such as cups for fear of contracting ritual impurity. So yes, in contemporary terms, Jesus is at the colored water fountain. But listen, that's not all. Not only is Jesus in Samaria, not only does he go to the colored water fountain, but he stops and starts talking to a Samaritan. Don't miss that. I already told you, in those days, the religious leaders did not like the Samaritans. So it's already enough to his disciples that he's in Samaria. It's already shocking enough that he's at the colored water fountain, and now he has the nerve to strike up a conversation. That was a radical act because customarily to the religious leaders of Jerusalem, the Samaritans were not even worthy of having a civil conversation with. The only time some religious leaders would speak to the Samaritans was simply only to put him or her down. But it gets even more shocking and radical than that. Not only is Jesus in Samaria, not only is he at the colored water fountain, not only is he talking to a Samaritan, but on top of that, it turns out that the Samaritan happens to be a woman. Remember, in those days, the religious leaders, they would not even teach women. In fact, self-righteous religious leaders would sometimes pray, "Lord, thank you I'm not a murderer. Thank you I'm not a tax collector. And thank you I'm not a woman." In those days, it was hard for women. They were discriminated against and thought of as second-class citizens. And yet, here is Jesus in Samaria at the colored water fountain, talking to a lowly Samaritan who has the double whammy of being a Samaritan woman. Women were so devalued and discriminated against that, according to tradition, Pharisees would sometimes, when an unknown woman was approaching them, they would close their eyes or turn away as not to even see her. In other words, as to render her invisible. I tell you, we see a lot of that today. For many marginalized groups in America are rendered invisible. We turn our eyes away from them through public policy and unfriendly and oppressive legislation. Legislation like HB 514, legislation like voter suppression laws, legislation like broken windows policing. That's why it's important to vote and engage civically, because through immoral legislation, we render people invisible because we don't want to see them. We don't want to know their struggles. We don't care about their pain. We don't perceive the image of God in their lives because of what some psychologists call a growing empathy gap Too often we render marginalized people and their struggles invisible. The working poor, invisible. The incarcerated, invisible. Gay and trans Americans, invisible. Those who grew up on the so-called wrong side of the tracks, invisible. Victims of domestic violence and sex trafficking, invisible. But what I love about the text is that Jesus sees the Samaritan woman in her particularity as a Samaritan and also as a woman. Come on now, Jesus doesn't pretend to be colorblind, and he doesn't pretend to be gender blind. Jesus teaches us the power and the necessity of seeing people in their particularities where bodies intersect with political agendas and economic opportunities or lack thereof. Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas says that by entering the space of the Samaritans, Jesus frees himself and the Samaritan woman from constructs that deem certain bodies superior and other bodies as inferior. And by doing so, Jesus gives up his privilege and enters into solidarity with the most put upon and oppressed bodies of his day. Jesus, Dr. Douglas says, rejects any notion of exceptionalism that may be attracted to his male Jewishness. And as such, he and the Samaritan woman virtually become equal. Thus, the first or the last. And that's what I love about this text, because it lets us know that Jesus sees everybody. He reaches across lines of color. He reaches across lines of social standing. He reaches across lines of gender and class, and Jesus writes everybody in. But here's where the text gets a little tricky. Because most evangelical interpreters assume that the Samaritan woman in the text is an immoral woman. When they read that the woman had five husbands in verses 16 through 18, they automatically assume that she is a loose woman who is going from man to man. Unfortunately, there's a long history of misogyny in Christian theology that stands in contradiction to the important role that women actually played in the Gospels. All four Gospels, for example, testify that women supported Jesus' ministry. They were present at the tomb, and even after the men ran away, they were the first ones to witness Jesus' resurrection. Yet from blaming Eve for the fall in the garden to assuming that this Samaritan woman must be a prostitute, there's an ugly taint of chauvinism in Christian theology. I wish I had time to deal with it, but most scholars agree that the five husbands in the text that's mentioned in verses 16 through 18 is better understood as gods or lords rather than actual husbands. That's because historically, Samaria had worshipped five different gods since the Assyria invasion, and the one they were worshiping now was not the God of Yahweh, but was the God of Rome. And this was not a condemnation of other religions, but rather it was a condemnation of the God of empire. Come on now, let me just say this. Far too Americans today are still worshiping the God of empire. Listen, if you think Donald Trump was placed in office by God, if you think it makes more sense to build a taller wall rather than a longer table, if you think it makes more sense to support tax breaks for the rich while the poor suffer and the middle class is shrinking, you are worshiping the God of empire. But there's something significant that's going on in the text. At this point in his ministry, Jesus is about to make a theological shift. Jesus is about to flip the script theologically. He's about to make a theological statement, and he's about to make a theological shift. He's about to send a message that salvation is not just for the Jewish community, but salvation is for everybody. And check out Jesus. At this momentous and crucial moment in history, during this groundbreaking and revolutionary theological shift, check out who Jesus uses. He uses a Samaritan woman, an outcast among outcasts. Listen, he doesn't go to the wealthy men of Samaria. He doesn't go to their religious leaders. Rather, Jesus chooses a woman who comes to the well at the hottest time of the day, a time no other people wanted to come to the well, which suggests that she probably was an outsider even in her own community. I love that about Jesus. I love that about Jesus. Jesus is not like us. Listen, when Jesus gets ready to save you, he doesn't engage in respectability politics. He doesn't run a credit report. He doesn't do a background check. He doesn't say, just pull your pants up, speak proper English, and be a good model Negro. But Jesus reaches out to the lowest of the lowest, the least, the less, the lost, and the left behind. Look at Jesus. When Jesus gets ready to upset the theological framework of the privileged, capitalistic, myopic, patriarchal, heteronormative, cisgender ruling class, Jesus chooses a woman from Samaria who is considered an outcast among outcasts on the lowest end of the power spectrum. In the idiom of the black church, can't nobody do me like Jesus. But listen, not everybody was happy. Because of Jesus' encounter with this Samaritan woman and other incidents like this, the religious leaders called Jesus everything but a child of God. In fact, on one occasion, the religious leaders, they pinned Jesus in a corner and they said, "We were right all along. You ain't nothing but a crazy Samaritan lover." Don't miss that. Does not that sound familiar? In the African-American experience in this country, before blacks were free, if a sympathetic white person embraced love or fought for the cause of black freedom, racist white folks labeled them N-word lovers. The Quakers were just N-word lovers. The abolitionists were just N-word lovers. Anybody who fought for the cause of black freedom were called N-word lovers. Can you imagine the crowd, the religious leader, ganging up on Jesus and mocking him, saying, "You ain't nothing but a crazy Samaritan lover." But I love the fact that Jesus doesn't reject the title. Jesus doesn't repudiate being thought of as a Samaritan because, as Jane Cone told us, Jesus most identifies with the crucified classes of society. I'll take my seat after I tell you this. I never forget, I was watching the movie called The Siege, starring Denzel Washington. Denzel Washington is playing an FBI agent, and he's upset after one of his fellow agents, who is an Arab, is unfairly arrested because of his heritage. Denzel is trying to get him out of prison, and he's upset when another soldier tells him to back off. And check it out. When Denzel Washington does not back off, the soldier says derisively, in an effort to intimidate Denzel, "I might just decide that you are an Ethiopian and put you in jail." To which Denzel responds, "And you're stupid enough to think that is an insult." Well, check it out. When they called Jesus a Samaritan, they were misguided enough to think that was an insult. But in my sanctified imagination, I believe Jesus must respond to, in the words of Beyonce, "You must not know about me." You must not know about me. I didn't come to establish an earthly kingdom. I came to set the captives free. I didn't come to make the wealthy feel good, but I came to liberate the oppressed. I didn't come to rubber stamp religious respectability, but I came to preach good news to the poor, to open the eyes of the blind, and to set at liberty those who are abused. You must not know about me. Anything you do to the least of these, you also do unto me. I am water for the thirsty. I am bread for the hungry. I am joy in the time of sorrow. I am hope for tomorrow. And listen, that's the good news of the gospel. Listen, Jesus doesn't redline salvation. Jesus doesn't gentrify grace. Jesus doesn't say you were born on the wrong side of the tracks, but God extends salvation to everybody. This story about the Samaritan woman rolls out the welcome mat of grace. This story represents God's equal access clause. This story highlights God's come as you are policy. This story is a declaration that all of God's children matter. Whoever you are, you matter. If you're black, you matter. If you're gay, you matter. If you're trans, you matter. If you're a woman, you matter. If you are poor, you matter. No matter your color, your creed, or national origin, sexual orientation, you matter to God. Red, yellow, black, or white, we're all precious in God's sight. You matter. And that is the radical and subversive love of Christ. Amen.